This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. No, really, it is all about the data. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Karin Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 8th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jay Powell, day two, Capitol Hill, clarifying what he said yesterday about data and interest rates.
If, and I stress that no decision has been made on this, but if the totality of the data were to indicate that faster tightening is warranted, we'd be prepared to increase the pace of rate hikes.
That no decision bit was the clarification after Wall Street took his comments yesterday as this week's sign the economic apocalypse is upon us. And the fact of the matter is there is a lot of new data yet to come and some that came in today, actually. The latest job openings and labor turnover survey was out this morning. The number of job openings down in January, but still quite high, almost 11 million help wanted ads out there. The number of people who quit fell as well. Layoffs were up. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the What Does It All Mean desk today.
You never want to put too much weight on any one particular number or data set, like today's JOLTS report.
But it should be evidence that what the Fed is trying to do is working.
Wendy Edelberg at the Brookings Institution says the reason she sounds a little hesitant there is that last month's jobs report was much stronger than she and other economists were expecting. But today's data showing that job openings and quits both fell and layoffs ticked up
was good news, but there's still a lot more to go. Baby steps. It's a baby step in the right direction.
So far, it's only in certain industries that the job market's cooling off. Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter says one that really stands out is construction.
Job openings fell an eye-popping 49% in construction. That's the industry to watch. That's the industry that is most likely to show job losses in response to high interest rates.
There were also fewer openings in accommodation and food services and in finance and insurance. Most layoffs were in professional and business services, which includes tech companies. Layla O'Kane at the labor market analytics company Lightcast says, perhaps unsurprisingly, that's also the industry where quits dropped off the most.
So that kind of means that people are thinking to themselves, hey, maybe this isn't a good time to leave my job. I'm not totally certain that I could find a new one.
But she says in other industries, people are still quitting their jobs and moving on to new ones, a sign that most of them aren't that nervous about the job market. Another indication that they aren't is that unemployment claims are still low. Michelle Evermore at the Century Foundation says that's despite the rise in layoffs.
I think that what we're seeing here is that people are relatively certain that when they lose a job, that they're going to be able to find another replacement job soon enough.
And for the most part, so far, that seems to be the case. There are still nearly two job openings for every available worker. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, maybe it turns out the apocalypse is not upon us. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We were talking over story ideas at our meeting this morning, and Kristen Schwab pointed out something that Powell said in his testimony yesterday, but which went by kind of quick. He was talking, Powell was, about how a lot of the indicators the Fed has been watching, employment, consumer spending, inflation, obviously, after starting to look a little bit friendlier, have all reversed in the past 5 weeks or so and are now distinctly less friendly. And then Kristen pointed out that Powell spent a very quick moment on how unusually warm weather in January might have messed with seasonally adjusted data, making the numbers look stronger than they actually are. Seasonally adjusted is a term that we throw around sometimes, but it's an important enough concept that Kristen wanted to take a second to explain exactly what it means. And I said in our meeting this morning, yes, great idea. And then I said, you got to explain it so my mom can follow it. And she said, really? And I said, yeah.
Hey, Mrs. Rizdahl, I know we've never met, so I'm going to let an expert convince you to listen to me unravel the wonkiness of seasonal adjustments. Here's economist Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan.
There are people who do this for a living, and it really, really, really matters.
Because seasonal adjustments allow us to factor in wild swings. Say we own an ice cream shop that sells a lot during summer and a little during winter. We know not to freak out when it starts snowing and sales dip, and we're better able to see when something unusual happens, like a spike.
We say, well, that must mean there's something good going on with ice cream sales.
Turns out our new brownie ice cream is drawing customers. Now, the government does this too, because our economy is always fluctuating. Like, if we didn't use seasonally adjusted numbers, it would look like we're heading into a recession every January, after the holidays, when retail sales tank. Jeffrey Myron is vice president of research at the Cato Institute.
But every once in a while, they don't quite happen to exactly the same degree, and that causes some confusion about what the data in a particular month or quarter actually mean.
The confusion is figuring out the outliers, the brownie ice creams. Sometimes they're obvious, like job numbers tanking because of COVID lockdowns or oil prices spiking because of the war in Ukraine. But January's outlier, maybe the unusually warm weather coaxed everyone outside and fueled inflation? Question mark? Jonathan Wright is an economist at Johns Hopkins.
It's very hard to explain that all with weather.
He says it's tough to trust data when the past three Januaries have been so weird. And though seasonal adjustments are based on several years of data, we're not in the same economy as 2019. So the risk is...
you can either overstate or understate the true strength of the economy.
Got that, Mrs. Rizdahl? If you have any questions, I know a radio host you can ask. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with Elizabeth Newberry. She's the chair of something called the Federal Games Guild, a group of people dedicated to games that teach people about public policy. And one of the games we talked about is a federal budgeting simulator called the Fiscal Ship. Do you know the secret cheat code for Fiscal Ship? I mean, all games have cheat codes, right?
Well, I can't give all of the secrets, but most of the time you can get to the goals and reducing national debt in about 14 moves or so.
The White House is set to release its budget proposal tomorrow, so I figured this was as good a time as any to try my hand. For those playing along at home, as it were, it's fiscalship.org, and that's where I am now on my computer here in the studio. And I'm just going to do what? Click on new game, right? Is that what I'm going to do?
Yeah.
Okay. That, yeah, is Louise Shaner. She's a senior fellow and policy director at the Hutchins Center at Brookings, which first launched the Fiscal Ship game in 2016. She talked me through the first section of it where you scroll through various options to pick your governing goals. Scrolling, scrolling, scrolling.
The reason we have the goals, the first thing that you choose, is we want people to realize that when we talk about taxes and spending and the numbers and the debt, that it's not just about the numbers, that you really do have a choice about how you want society to run and that you need to sort of get the numbers to work within the context of those goals.
All right, fair enough. So I'm going to choose some governing goals here, and I'm going to choose my own just because I can. I chose Joe Biden's priorities because he's in the White House. fight climate change because I have kids, and increase national security because that's kind of my background.
All right, I'm clicking on let's go. Okay. Great. Oh, man, now what do I do? Okay. So I've got a bunch of stuff that says stuff that's in the news. I've got health policies. I've got taxes on investments. What do I do here?
So you click on one of those categories.
Okay.
And each of those things are going to have a bunch of policies that you can use that is going to affect the debt to GDP ratio. Because the idea of the game is to find the policies that are consistent with your values that stabilize the debt to GDP ratio in 25 years at today's level.
Today's debt-to-GDP ratio, by the way, is about 120%, basically double what it was just before the Great Recession.
Yeah, can you tell me why that's important, please, stabilizing the debt-to-GDP ratio? Why is that the thing?
Right. So eventually, we have to stabilize our debt-to-GDP ratio in the sense that we can't keep on borrowing more and more and more. As the debt increases, we have interest rates increasing, and we're going to have to divert more and more of our spending towards paying that interest. And you can't keep on borrowing it indefinitely. At some point, people say, well, you're not going to pay it back. So we eventually have to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio. The game is a game. And so the game says, let's just stabilize it at today's level. You know, is that what I would choose? Perhaps not. Perhaps I would actually let it go a little bit higher. But I'd still have to stabilize it eventually.
All right. So I'm going to click on the In the News tab. And let's see. So this will give me a little bunch of things that are in the news here. Is that the deal? So I've got decreasing IRS funding. I've got boost taxes on the super rich. I've got eliminate grants for state and local transit. Eliminate the EPA. That's a big one. And tax breaks for fossil fuels. Repeal the 2017 corporate tax cuts. Combat the opioid epidemic. All right. So just because that seems like a reasonable thing to do, I want to combat the opioid epidemic. So I'm going to click on that. And I'm going to add the policy to my plan. And there we go. Oh, debt's gone up. Huh. Well, that's interesting. I tried expanding unemployment benefits, too. And debt keeps going up. Huh. Interesting. All right. So I need to look for some things where I'm going to make some money here, right?
You do.
All right. Well, where might those be? Tax credits and deductions? No.
Well,
all right. Income and payroll taxes.
Let's try that.
Over in that category, I spotted increasing taxes on people who make more than $400,000 a year, which is one that President Biden has talked about, too.
So I'm choosing that policy. And, it brought it down a little bit. But okay, sorry. I'm looking at this little symbol on the right hand side, and the fiscal ship is not only is it like halfway sunk, but it's raining and there's thunderstorms. So clearly, yes. I'm not doing very well at this game. I tried raising taxes on the wealthy even more. My ship is still sinking. And then I gave up. Okay, stop. Hold on a minute. There is no way to win this game.
You can win this game.
You cannot win this game. How do you win this game?
I think the game illustrates that we actually have to make some hard choices, not some little easy choices. You can increase taxes a whole bunch more than you're increasing them. You could impose a carbon tax. So there's lots of ways to win, but you just have to be willing to make those trade-offs. You're going to have to sacrifice someplace.
This is a question probably beyond the scope of this interview, and you may actually decide to duck it somehow, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It seems to me that we in this country have a history of not wanting to pay for all the things we want. Discuss.
I think that is sort of true. If you look at the past history of the debt to GDP ratio, it actually was fairly stable for a long time. It increased a lot during the Great Recession. It increased a lot during the pandemic. But we haven't just had this, you know, ever increasing debt to GDP ratio. Now we're facing this very big transition in our economy, right? We're facing a transition that's coming from aging to a large extent. If we figure out a way of lowering health spending, that would go a long way. So, I mean, I think we are not going to allow the debt to GDP ratio to increase forever. I think we will
to interrupt. Have you met the Congress of the United States?
I mean, but I'm just saying historically, you know, at some point, if interest rates stay high, if people start worrying about it, it becomes a big deal, there will be more pressure. Right now, there isn't a lot of pressure. And part of the reason of that is that up until very recently, interest rates were extremely low. When interest rates are extremely low, debt is just not that costly. And it sort of makes sense to stop focusing on it. And so a big question now is what happens to interest rates? Do they stay high relative to what they've been recently, or do they go back down to very low levels, in which case high debt is not such a big deal?
Right. And that actually gets me to another question. And setting aside for a second the Fed and what it's doing and how long it might have to keep interest rates high, you know how when the CBO comes out and Congress comes out or whoever comes out and makes these 10-year budget forecasts and everybody goes, oh, come on, you can't figure out what this economy is going to do in 10 years, and you're doing it for a math exercise. It's really challenging here to try to figure out what this economy is going to be doing, you know, in a month, let alone in 10 years, or when a lot of these policies that I'm picking in this game, but in which Congress people are picking in reality, it's really tough to figure out what this is actually going to do.
Totally, totally. So this game goes out 25 years, so it's even harder, right? Yeah, imagine if you thought about 25 years ago predicting what the economy would be today. And then the question is, okay, so there's a lot of uncertainty, but you still know that these basic trade-offs are going to happen. You need to go for some of the big ticket items to actually make a real dent.
Have you played this thing and have you won?
I have played it and won, but yeah, I can't just play it and win in 3 minutes.
you know the cheat code. That's all I'm saying. You know the cheat
code.
That's true. Louis Shaner and the game. It's called fiscalship.org. Louis, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up.
You put your young analyst in a lightless office in the middle, and that's okay.
Not okay, though, to turn a lightless office into a lightless apartment. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 58 points today, about 0.2%, closed at 32,798. The NASDAQ picked up 45 points, about 0.4% there, 11,576. The S&P 500 up 5, about 0.1%, 39.92. Samantha told us a little something about employment earlier, so let's check out some big employers in this economy did on Wall Street today. Walmart, with something like 2,300,000 workers, subtracted 0.8%. Amazon's got about 1.6 million employees, tacked on 0.4%, just under 500,000 people work at Home Depot. Shares there picked up 1%. All right, so look, you're driving and the steering wheel comes clean off. Bad dream? Real. Apparently, federal safety officials are investigating Tesla's 2023 Model Y SUV for this very problem. The new probe, it should be said here, is based on two complaints. Tesla dropped 0.3, not 0.3, actual full 3%. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.98%. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It'll be 3 years next Monday that the federal government paused student loan payments. We are now on the 8th extension of that pause, which means borrowers with federal student loan debt have had no payments due or interest accrued in all that time. And now private sector lenders are saying enough. SoFi, which competes with the federal government to hold that debt, has sued the Department of Education, saying the latest extension of the pause was illegal. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes walks us through the student debt marketplace.
To understand what's happening with student debt, let's think of lenders as brands of soda.
Well, it's sort of like the Coke and Pepsi wars, right?
Jonathan Fansmith works in government relations at the American Council on Education.
But then Coke decides midway through the wars, we're not going to charge anyone. Which brand are you going to buy, right?
And in this case, one brand has a lot more market share. The federal government holds 93% of the $1.7 trillion in outstanding student debt. Borrowers usually only seek out private lenders if they either need more money than the government will lend them, or they can get a better interest rate. Jason Delisle is with the Urban Institute.
In the federal loan program, since the payment pause started, interest rates are effectively zero.
And in its lawsuit, private lender SoFi says it can't compete with that.
Their business model is mostly ruined as long as that is in place.
SoFi also says the Biden administration overreached in its latest extension. Scott Buchanan leads the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, a trade association, of which SoFi is an affiliate member. He says the losses suffered by companies will get passed on to their customers.
And if those loan costs are higher because of a mix of things, including higher interest rates, but also lost revenue, those indirectly always arrive back at the consumer.
But an abrupt end to the moratorium would have costs as well, says Jonathan Fansmith with the American Council on Education.
Rushing borrowers back before they're ready and before the Department of Education is ready is going to cause a lot of chaos and harm to borrowers.
The Department of Education said in a statement that the payment pause is legal and this lawsuit's an attempt by a multi-billion dollar company to make money while they force 45 million borrowers back into repayment. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
There are a whole lot of office buildings in this country that are, shall we say, underutilized. People straight up working at home or going hybrid a couple of days a week means cities including San Francisco and Houston and Washington, D.C. have office vacancy rates north of 15%. And by the end of this decade, the commercial real estate firm Cushman & Wakefield figures there's going to be more than a billion square feet of vacant office space in this economy. You know who could use some of that space? People. People in need of affordable places to live. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, converting office space to apartments is not as simple as it might seem.
The 15-story Fidelity and Deposit building in downtown Baltimore has sat empty for nearly two decades. Inside the lobby, its former grandeur is evident in the ornate marble columns and faded gold detailing on the arched ceiling.
So this is all like original architecture from, I think, 1890, I want to say.
It was finished in 1894. Patrick Grace is the owner of Trademark Investments, which bought this building last year and plans to convert the former office tower into more than 200 rental apartments.
For us, this was like a perfect opportunity because like the location's great, the building's awesome.
And it's full of vintage charm, like the giant bank vault in a space Grace plans to turn into a restaurant, and the intricately carved railing on the staircase.
That would be insanely expensive to try to recreate, and it looks nicer than like a builder's grade staircase that we would do now.
Converting an old building presents its own challenges, like adding a second stairwell to meet residential code. Trademark bought the building for $6 million and will put another $47 million into construction. This place emptied out long before the pandemic, but the recent increase in vacant office space around the country has more developers looking at conversions.
It's been increasing in the last 3 years by about 5 to 10% in terms of total square footage each and every year of converted offices.
Doug Ressler follows the commercial real estate market at the research firm Yardi Matrix. Between 2020 and 2021, Yardi data shows office to apartment conversions grew faster than new construction, adding 11,000 apartments nationally. New York City recently announced plans to create thousands more.
One of the things that you see is a tremendous amount of pressure on governments, cities, states, to be able to meet the affordable housing, you know, shortfall that has really been with us for almost a decade now.
But Ressler and others doubt that office conversions will make a big dent in that shortfall. Kevin Fagan is head of commercial real estate analysis at Moody's Analytics, which last year evaluated about 1,100 office buildings in New York City for potential conversion.
We basically found that about maybe 3% could be viable.
There are just too many obstacles, Fagan says. A lot of offices, for instance, don't have much natural light.
You're not living there. You're there for a certain amount of time, and you put your young analyst in a kind of a lightless office in the middle, and that's okay.
As a place to live, that's not going to work. There may be existing tenants to buy out, plumbing and windows to replace.
A lot of times in the development world, what people will say is that you're better off building from scratch than you are doing a renovation.
For Pat Grace at Trademark Properties, the end result is worth the hassle.
It's going to look awesome, right? It's like you're walking into a building that's done and it's modern, but you have this like piece of history that is still alive.
To see what a finished office-turned-apartment looks like, Trademark's asset manager, Ava Hodsden, takes me to another old building the company is converting nearby. Inside, the apartments mostly look like what you'd find in any new building, with quartz countertops and stainless appliances.
So this is probably, out of all the units that I have,
the one that might feel the most commercial conversion.
Hosden shows me a ground floor unit with floor-to-ceiling windows looking right out onto the busy sidewalk.
So if a tenant comes in here and they're like, I want this whole window screened or I want some sort of soundproofing on it, it's always a conversation we're open to because we want this space to work for them as well.
Hosden lives in a converted apartment herself in a former law office. Other than the dark wood paneling and some legal motifs in the building, she says you'd never know. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we leave you where we started. Fed Chair Jay Powell on Capitol Hill answering. Representative Ayanna Pressley asking.
So on behalf of the people of this country, to prevent a recession, yes or no, Chairman Powell, will you pause future interest rate hikes?
We're not seeking to have a recession, and we don't think we need to have a recession to get
respectfully
price stability back.
Will you pause interest rate hikes, yes or no?
I don't do yes or no on will I pause interest rate hikes. Yeah, that's a serious question, and I can't tell you because I don't know all the facts.
Here's your moment of economic context. You decide what this means economic data-wise. The Fed's Beige Book came out today. It's a look at the U.S. economy region by region. And from the good people at the Minneapolis Fed, this item, and I quote, a Montana construction firm has found it economical to rent a jet to fly workers into one of its plants to fill operational needs. Hiring local employees, the company went on, would be our first choice. But we had to adjust when we could not staff that way. Huh. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.